and good evening. My name is Bertha Khan, and on behalf of Ismaili Tariqa and Religious Education Board, I would like to welcome you all to this evening's seminar by Professor Muhammad Arkoun, one of the leading thinkers in the Islamic world. This seminar is part of an ongoing initiative to acquaint members of the Jama'ah on the contemporary issues facing Muslim societies and has been conceived to provide a space for exploration of the diversity and pluralism of Islam within its fundamental unity. A space where hopefully we can learn from each other and continue in our journeys towards greater understanding. As individuals, we have different perspectives on various issues. The speakers will be inviting from time to time, no doubt will have their own viewpoints based on their research, experience, and understanding. The intention of this lecture is not to take any one or other fixed position, as much as to learn about various issues with the point to engender a greater understanding of them, keeping in mind that faith, culture, and civilizations of a billion people dispersed across the globe encompass multiple diversities and therefore cannot be viewed as monolithic. We have here today all of you participating. This is a commitment, and I thank you all for joining us in this journey. Our guest speaker, Professor Muhammad Arkoun, is here as a guest of University of Toronto, and as usual, in his kindness and commitment way, has agreed to speak tonight. We are also very fortunate to have Rai Muhammad Keshavji, who is the International Coordinator for ITRIB activities. He's here on his personal business work, yet he's agreed to be here with us tonight. I want to thank you both for being here. Thank you very much. We'd also request you to please take a few minutes to view the display of publications produced by IIS. Our members will be on hand to answer any questions related to the curriculum material. Finally, once again, I welcome you here tonight and look forward to a stimulating intellectual evening. I will call upon Rai Muhammad Keshavji to introduce our guest speaker and to say a few words. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. We are fortunate tonight to have with us one of the most outstanding thinkers of our time, to whom both Muslim and non-Muslim scholars pay regular tribute. Professor Muhammad Arkoun was born in Algeria and has spent many years of his life in Europe, where he is presently based. He holds the chair of Arabic and Islamic thought at the Sorbonne. He has been a visiting professor at various international universities, ranging from Harvard and Princeton to Amsterdam and Berlin. And has also heard in important coteries of reflection in the Islamic world. His thoughts on history, philosophy, and culture have made him an intellectual par excellence, a voice to reckon with, not only by the Western world, but also by people in the Muslim world. Students of Islam today, in various parts of the world, are studying his thoughts for their PhD thesis. In a world where Islam is unfortunately projected as a monolith on the march, Professor Arkoun uses the rigor of modern academic disciplines to meticulously remove the cobwebs of history and passionately calls for a new way of thinking. His book, Rethinking Islam, in which he seeks to answer questions posed by his fellow intellectuals, shows the esteem in which he is held. Some years ago, the Times of London paid a rare tribute to the Muslim world by quoting his thoughts in an editorial on a major conference which was then being held in Germany. Mohammed Arkun, over the past 2 years, 2 decades, has played a major role in the Aga Khan Award for Architecture. He was also one of the main conceptualizers of the new graduate program at the Institute of Ismaili Studies, to which Ismaili students from various parts of the world are being attracted for their future studies. He is also a member of the Board of Governors of the Institute of Ismailis, and at present is a visiting professor at the IIS. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I call upon Professor Mohammed Arkun to speak to us. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Ali Madad, as you say. It's always a great honor for me and a pleasure to meet members of the community whom I get now to know fairly good, because since more than 15 years now, I have the privilege, as you know, to work with His Highness, to share His vision and to serve this vision with all my conviction and my intellectual commitment. Commitment to His vision and through His vision, commitment to all Muslim world, contemporary Muslim world. And through Muslim world, I try to share also the main intellectual currents in thinking about problems of our time. Because we need urgently in Muslim world to know better than we do so far, than we did so far, the new intellectual discoveries in the field of history of our civilizations and in the field of history of religions in plural. This is an essential point, especially at the end of this century, where we see religions coming back, taking more and more importance in our life, while in Europe, we thought since 19th century that religions have done their historical role and they are over. We discover that religions are coming back, even in Europe, where a major intellectual shift happened in 18th century with what we call reason of enlightenment. We shall come back to this. I propose that we reflect this evening on Islam facing modernity. Of course, this topic is dealt in many books, in many circumstances, by many scholars, but we didn't yet come to a true understanding of what is at stake in this interface between what we call Islam and what we call modernity. How to approach Islam through modernity? What can Islam say today about what is called modernity and developed mainly in the West, apart from what is going on in Islam? Both concepts are difficult to analyze, and they even become more and more difficult when we see, especially, what is happening in Muslim world since the last 30 years after the Second World War. I propose that we start from a short definition of contemporary Islam, because the main issues that we have to face are related to the major events which took place after the Second World War and which changed the thinking, changed the understanding of Islam by Muslims themselves, not to speak on the perception, the more and more negative perception of Islam by the West. So, how can we speak about contemporary Islam? What is happening in the Muslim world since the end of the Second World War? As you know, Islam has been used in all Muslim countries as a reference to oppose to colonial domination during the 19th century the strong affirmation of an Islamic identity. Nationalist movements have used at first intellectual references to what we learned in the first half of this century from the history of Europe. They didn't refer so much to religion, but they used, nevertheless, religion as a part of identity, of cultural identity. This has played a role in the movements of liberation from colonial domination during the 50s. But during the 50s until the 60s, as you remember, the reference to socialist ideology, to communist ideology, has been stronger than the reference to religion, than the reference to Islam. You can remember the international conference which has been held in Bandung in Indonesia in 1953. President Nasser from Egypt, President Nehru from India, President Tito from Yugoslavia. These three personalities played a big role in raising the issue of political liberation of all the dominated countries by Europe during the 19th century. And they raised this necessity of liberation by referring to the communist ideology of liberation. And you remember the role of communism after the Second World War in all Third World countries. In Tanzania, for example, many of you know what has happened in Tanzania in relation to this big movement of liberation, where references to what was called then socialist ideology, communist ideology, was more important than the reference to Islam. Nevertheless, I repeat, reference to Islam was made already, especially in Egypt, in Middle East, to Islam, because we know that the association of Muslim brothers has been founded in Egypt in 1928, and already we can observe a split between two trends, two elites. The elites which was referring to a thinking coming from Europe, socialist thinking, democratic thinking, liberal thinking, and another trend referring more to Islam. This is important to know from now, because this will explain how these two elites will develop parallelly, opposed to each other, because one was thinking in the horizon of using Islam as a religion to get to this liberation, and the other movement was looking rather to reason of enlightenment as Europe used it in 19th century to build their own independence based on the nation states as it developed in Italy, in France, in Germany, etc. So you see that up to 50s and 60s, Islam was there, reference to Islam was there, but it was challenged by the other conception of liberation, which was the conception of modern liberal thinking and the conception of bringing more democracy in Muslim societies. We have no time to elaborate on these two movements and to show how it came to an unbalanced situation. I mean that after 60s, there is another event that we have to mention to understand what has happened and why we are at the point we are now. This new factor is demographic. Demography in all Muslim countries has grown during the last 30 years with such a speed that today we see in all these countries demography which has grown up by 3/3 to what it was in the 60s and the 50s. For example, in Algeria or Morocco, we were 9 million in 1960, we are now 30 million. You look to Indonesia, to Bangladesh, to India, everywhere you have the same proportion. This has changed the social balance of forces. And the new generations, which are all young generations, have grown up in the ideological atmosphere of the new independent states. States which emerged in the 50s and the 60s. And the ideology implemented by these states are nationalist ideologies based on a kind of teaching using Islam at schools, but using Islam not with a scientific presentation, with an objective presentation, but with an ideological presentation to strengthen the legitimacy of the state more than to give an enlightened understanding of Islam as a culture, of Islam as a tradition of thinking. The history of Islamic thought, for example, until today is very much neglected in the teaching at school as well as at the universities. We teach more some beliefs, religious beliefs, than intellectual history of Islamic thought, as it has been in the medieval ages, in the classical period. This is a very important point, and you know that this, what I am saying, touches also Ismaili community about the teaching which is given until today on Islam as a religion, because we must make a distinction between Islam as a religion, as a system of beliefs, and non-beliefs, beliefs and non-beliefs. It's important to know that non-beliefs, what we should not believe, which is ordered by Islam. For example, how Muslims speak about the personality of Jesus. We are required to believe that Jesus is not the Son of God, but he is a prophet. This is a non-belief. And we are required to believe that God is one, and there is no Trinity. So you see, to have a good understanding of what a religion is, it's not only for Islam. All religions are systems of beliefs and system of non-beliefs. So the teaching of Islam as a religion at school didn't develop the intellectual side of Islamic thought. They insisted only on the beliefs. Even the teaching of beliefs has been most of the time wrong. For example, how our children have been taught about the position of Islam towards Jews and Christians. You heard about the events which happened in Algeria very few times ago, how Christians are considered in Algeria by those Muslims who are interpreting the Quran on their way, which is not what the Quran actually says about Ahlul Kitab, the peoples of the book. So this point of education, after the independence of most Muslim countries, has played a very important role in giving a large social support to the teaching of an Islam used as an ideological weapon more than as a religion, more than as a faith, more than as a spiritual education of Muslims. The other point to understand what has happened in contemporary Islam and which orientation contemporary Islam took in looking back to its past and looking to Western culture, Western tradition of thinking, is that we developed after the 70s and the 80s an ideology of struggle and an ideology of rejection towards the West being considered as a materialist civilization, while Islam is presented as a spiritualist civilization. This is, of course, an ideological presentation, not the real history of religions and the real history of thought as we know it if we study it as historians, not as ideologists. When we study the history of Christianity, for example, and we compare the history of Christianity to the history of Islam, we discover that Christianity has as much concern about spirituality, as much concern about faith, than Islam has developed. So this is also a lack of attention given to the study of history. And until today, the study of history not only of Islam, but history of compared religions, this is not yet introduced in our system of education, because today it's not enough to teach Islam as a religion, Islam as a tradition of thinking. We need to teach a compared approach, a compared understanding, a compared analysis of what the three revealed religions are historically. For this, I would like to show you exactly the map that we have to have in mind when we want to understand Islam among the religions which emerged and developed in the Middle East. You see in the middle phenomenon of the book, what we call the holy book or the holy scriptures. I call it a phenomenon because it is something which emerges in a time of history, and we have to look at it and to understand this phenomenon before we speak through our belief that the Quran is revealed by God and it is the only one book which is revealed, and we disregard the rest. A historical presentation should look to what has happened in history before getting into theological definitions. So the phenomenon of the book in the Middle East includes what we call the Bible, which has been revealed through
Israel prophets, on which the Quran speaks a lot. Then it includes what Christians call the Gospels, which are also mentioned in the Quran and recognized in the Quran. And then we have the Quran, which came only during the period 610 to the period 632. And this phenomenon of the book is a cultural phenomenon which has spread in the Middle East and through Judaism, through Christianity and through Islam. It went in Europe and it went in Asia and it went in Africa. So you see how this has developed. Roman Christianity, which went to Europe, Byzantine Christianity, with which Islam, when it emerges, had to fight during many centuries. It has a long history. I don't have time to elaborate on it. And Islam, from 7th century until 13th century, has been what historians present as an intermediate civilization. What does this mean? It means that Islam has been the intermediary, in space, because it went to Africa, it went to Asia, it went to Europe, and it spread the idea which was already developed in the Bible and in the Gospels. And it is also the intermediary in time, because Islam, as a culture and a civilization, has lifted up the ancient Middle East, ancient Near East civilizations to the civilization which will develop in Europe after 13th century. For example, Islamic thought has developed a great interest in Greek philosophy, which is a part of the culture which existed in Middle East centuries before Islam came. And we see then the development after 13th century, will come to one part, which is the third world countries, as we call it, Bandung Conference, which I mentioned. And on the other part, since 16th century, we have European development. Since 16th century, we have precisely the development of what we call modernity. And modernity will develop in Europe without the participation of Islam as a culture, Islam as a tradition of thinking. This is an important point to teach to our children, to teach to our students, to understand why today the present Islam cannot share all the thinking developed under the name of modernity, because there has been a rupture between Europe and Islam since 16th century until 19th century, when Europeans came and introduced these ideas of modernity after 19th century. The other to show exactly what has happened since 16th century in Europe on one side, in Islamic world on the other side, we have to insist on the role played by reason of enlightenment in Europe in 18th century. What is this reason of enlightenment? Why is it called enlightenment? In Europe, like in Islam, reference to religion has been dominant during all the medieval ages. Christianity dominated the state. Christianity dominated the law. Christianity dominated all social, political, juridical institutions in Europe, just as Islamic law dominated also the caliphate, the imamate with Shi'i and the caliphate with Sunni. It dominated all juridical institutions. All political institutions were controlled through the ulama. Like in Christianity, all has been controlled also by the church, the hierarchy of the church. So we have the same situation in Islam as well as in Christianity. Religion represented the sphere of authority, of spiritual authority, and the state represented the sphere of political power in Christianity as well as in Islam. There is no difference. What will make the difference? The difference will come from the English Revolution, political revolution, American Revolution in 18th century, and more radically, the French Revolution in 18th century. What has happened? What has happened is the suppression of all references to the religious teachings, the separation between the state and the church, the total autonomy, the total independence of human reason in elaborating law, in running political institutions, in running all social issues, in running the system of education. Everything is now, after these revolutions I mentioned, totally independent from any reference to the holy books, to the holy scriptures, to the religious law. This is a major shift in the history of human mind. It affects the position of reason towards religion and the interpretation of religion and the role of religion in societies. That's why there has been in Europe a struggle between the Christian believers who were fighting to keep the ancient system, to keep the control of religion over the state, over the system of education, over social life, etc., and those who were gained to the new position, saying that after the revolution, religion is a private affair. It is not anymore a public affair. You can be a believer, you see it here, how it goes here in Canada. You can be a believer, it's your personal decision. And this personal decision cannot be a problem which can be debated in the public space. This is the new system which is established in all European countries, including, of course, America, because America is the product, is the intellectual product of Europe, because it has been created by Europeans. And you know today that we have problems in Europe because of this split between reference to religion and reference to the state. You heard about problems, for example, we have in France about the scarf at school, because according to law of the separation between religion and the state, you cannot bring in a public space, and school is a public space, you cannot bring signs of your belonging to a faith, and you cannot show this ostensibly to say, here I am, a Muslim, because at school, in European societies today, which are pluralist societies, we have many people coming from all cultures, from all religions, in one class you have many children who refer to many religions, so it is dangerous if each one does this. Of course, that's why they have a system saying we are neutral, the school is neutral about religion. Religion is a private affair. And at the moment of the evolution which took place in Muslim societies since the last 50s, the last 60s, as I told you, we didn't give enough attention to this point of reason of enlightenment, which is the heart, the intellectual heart of what we call modernity. Because, as I used to say, we must make a distinction between material modernity and intellectual modernity. Material modernity, we have almost integrated it, because we have all the new tools, the technology, the good cars, etc. We have telephone. All this is material modernity. Although this material modernity is produced by the mind also, by an intellectual endeavor. But the intellectual modernity looks more to the problems of meaning. As I, you saw the title of what I presented, I called it The Quest for Meaning, The Quest for Meaning and The Will to Power. I must show this again because it is, you see, The Quest for Meaning and The Will to Power in the Mediterranean Area. Look to this title. It is an extremely important one. Because in the Mediterranean Area there has been, all along history, a constant fighting, a constant struggle between different conceptions of meaning. What is meaningful for human existence? Jews will say, our tradition, our teaching is more meaningful than your teaching, you Christians, or your teaching, you Muslims. Christians will say the same to the other. That's why we have a system of exclusion, of mutual exclusion. Meaning became, in the Mediterranean Area, through the three religions, a weapon to affirm the monopoly of truth for each community and the exclusion of the other truths. Muslims did it too. When Islam was in power, because Islam has been in power for centuries, in the Mediterranean Area, Islam developed a concept of exclusion of the other definitions of truth, Christian definition and the Jewish definition. That's why it is extremely important to understand why reason of enlightenment fought to get to a position which is far from the religious positions which were fighting and struggling and excluding each other. Reason of enlightenment found an intellectual position, a scientific position, to regard the positions developed by religion with a critical approach, with a critical scientific approach. This is extremely important. I have no time to develop the idea that Muslim thinkers in the classical time, I mean from 8th century to 13th century, this is the classical time of Islamic thought, which is not yet well taught in our schools. And we try to do something in the Institute precisely in that direction, to know better the importance of this split, the intellectual split between reason of enlightenment and reason which is still repeating the definition of truth as it was prevailing in the medieval ages, without looking what has happened through the history of thought in Mediterranean area, especially between these three religions, facing modernity as it is expressed by reason of enlightenment. Yet we didn't get enough benefit from this, because yet our teaching is not yet up to that level, not of disregarding religions, not of rejecting religions, no, but to rethink the issue of religion from a position of neutral attitude towards what each religion is teaching, is proclaiming. That's why today we have the task to come back to our tradition, to reread our tradition, to reinterpret our tradition, taking into account for the first time, and we are far from doing it, the lessons which we can get from the struggle between theological reason and reason of enlightenment, and even more today, because reason of enlightenment itself today in Europe, again, only in Europe, you see, in Europe, very important things happened intellectually, which didn't happen in China, in India, in Africa, in Islam. This is important to ask why that, what has happened that such important intellectual steps have been made in Europe and they didn't happen in other cultures and civilizations. This is an important question to ask, to focus on in our teaching too. So today we go further than reason of enlightenment about religions, but I shall come back to that. To this, it is also something very important to introduce in our teaching. Unfortunately, we have to do this work in the atmosphere, in the ideological, political atmosphere, which is dominated, as you know, by terrorism. There is terrorism in Muslim societies. Terrorism became a weapon, a political weapon. Fortunately, you are safe from this, because you don't have a territory, you don't have a state, as I repeat it always. This is a privilege, to not have a state and to not have a territory to defend, because you are free to give attention to problems like the problems we are discussing here. But unfortunately, most of the countries have a state, they have a territory, so they are engaged in political struggle inside, and this political struggle evolved, as you know, in many countries towards the use of terrorism. That's why today it's extremely difficult to tackle basic issues in Islamic thought to get into the heart of modernity. And one of these basic issues from which we have to start, all of us, whether we are Ismailis, we are Imamis, we are Kharijit, we are Sunnit, we are whatever, all of us, we have to come back to the starting point where Islam started and where Islam has expressed itself for the first time, the Quran, of course. Quran. How to approach the Quranic phenomenon? Big question. Enormous question. Especially today, because this question today is ideologically a taboo. We cannot tackle it. We cannot approach it. Because the Quran is used as a political reference more. It's impossible. Because medicine has totally changed. Similarly, linguistics, studying languages, has changed totally. I don't have time, and it's too complicated to give you examples of the big changes which happened in linguistics. That's why we have to change totally the interpretations given by Muslim exegetes in medieval ages, and we cannot anymore rely on it. And what is happening? What is taught at the universities? Still, the interpretation of Tabari is taught in many universities and at schools. Look what is happening. Where is the Muslim who would accept to be cured by a physician trained in Avicenna medicine? No one would accept. But we accept that the Quran is read with the rules and the conceptions of linguistics in medieval ages. That's what we are doing. Even in this mighty community, you do it. I tell you that I hope some change will happen. Yes, it's important. And another discipline of which we did not yet have, we do not teach it. We try to introduce it at the institute. But it's very hard. And we don't find even professors to teach properly anthropology applied to the study of religions. We cannot understand nothing about the Quran if we do not make the distinction, and I have no time to elaborate also, between mythical knowledge. Because it's a knowledge. Myth is the truth put in a literary narration. And this truth is integrated by all people because it is taught orally. It is not taught by written books. So everyone can participate. This is the mythical knowledge. For example, the Quran, when the Quran says that Abraham came and brought the Kaaba to the Kaaba in Mecca, a historian today would say, which date he came, where he came from, which route he took, etc., etc., to make all precisions, if it happened or not. Did Abraham exist ever? Yes, historians are asking. Did he exist as a person, like they say, did Jesus exist? They raise the issue. The mythical knowledge does not raise any of these issues. He listens, he gets into the mind all what is presented in a literary, beautiful way, and we take this as the reliable truth. So if you are not able to make this distinction between mythical knowledge and historical knowledge, you are going to be totally wrong about the stories, many stories which are taught in the Quran. He says, "Inna naqussu alayka ahsan al-qasas." We tell you the most beautiful stories. It says the Quran. We tell you the most beautiful stories. So, this is also a major point to insist on if we want to jump over the gap, the historical gap, which separates Islam from this modernity and even post-modernity. Let's say a word now on this presentation. You see, we start from the concept of the Word of God. We say that the Quran contains the Word of God. The Word of God is a theological concept. It is very difficult to grasp because it is an abstract concept. And it is apart from the concrete concept that we can control, that we can study, which will come after. The first manifestation, concrete manifestation of the Word of God is the Quranic discourse. or the biblical discourse, or the gospel discourse. Discourse is something which has been articulated in a given language, in a human language, by a human person, which has been heard by people. For example, Jesus articulated his teaching in Aramaic language, which is a Semitic language like Arabic language. Prophets of Israel have spoken also in a Semitic language, Hebrew. Similarly, the Quran has been articulated in Arabic language. What's the meaning of Quranic discourse? The most important aspect of this concept is that the Quran, like Gospels, like the Bible, has been delivered orally, not by writing. It has been an oral delivery. From the linguistic point of view, there is an enormous difference for meaning between the speech delivered orally and the speech just written. Imagine, for example, that what I'm saying since the beginning of this lecture, with my hand speaking, with my face speaking, with my body meaning something, and I'm looking to you whether you are interested or you are bored by what I'm saying, etc. There is an interface, there is an exchange between you and me, and all this affects the discourse, the oral living discourse. And if you didn't understand something, you disagree with something, you will ask questions after I finished. They will, the interface will continue. You may put me in difficulty. Yes? This is the privilege of oral delivery. And then there is all the ambiguous points of the discourse, which will remain when it is only written, are all clarified. It can be clarified between you and me. So you see the step, which is a historical step. During 20 years, the Prophet has delivered orally the discourse to different audiences, different listeners, in different circumstances. That's why there is always a change, an adaptation. There are many verses, for example, which contradict each other. But there is no contradiction because they have been delivered in different circumstances where they have their own meaning in the circumstances. And you see how we forget to point out to this extremely important moment of revelation. Normally, to have a right interpretation, we have to go back to this oral delivery, not to the written text as we read it now. So, second step, history. You see history, how history is different from theological teaching. In theology, I would not say something such thing. It's not necessary. I would just say the Quran. The Quran is the word of God, and God is saying this and this. And I go on. Where is the meaning? How I manipulate the meaning? How I disregard important aspects of the meaning? If I go, I neglect this step, decisive step, then we come to what I call the official closed corpus. This is a very, very heavy, loaded concept. Official and closed. You understand. I don't need to explain, although there is a terrible battle about the closing of the corpus. The corpus is the book that we have today in our hands. This is the corpus, the collection of all the verses. This is the corpus, the body. of text. But this has been made under the control of some people. And it took a long time before the corpus has been declared closed. Closed, it means nothing ever can be changed in it. You cannot take out something from it. You cannot bring in something which was not there after the corpus has been declared closed. What I'm saying here about the Quran, you can apply it exactly to the corpus of the Bible. And you can apply it exactly to the corpus of the Gospels. There has been many Gospels circulated. And only four of them have been selected by the Church and declared acceptable, reliable, orthodox. The same thing happened for the Quran. So, what we are reading today as the Quran is actually, from the historical point of view, the official closed corpus. And the official closed corpus, as I said, is a written text. The oral delivery has disappeared. So you see the situation created by this new step, new historical step in the history of the Quran as a revelation. So, once the corpus is what it is, and it became what it is after 9th and 10th centuries. I mean that the Quran of course existed as it is, but there was discussions about the readers of the Quran, the specialists who were reading the Quran, about the content of it, whether we should add something or take out something. And the discussion has been totally closed about this in 10th century. After this, we have another step, which is extremely important also to consider apart. It is the step which I call the interpreted corpuses. This means that many Muslims were interested in understanding the Quran, in interpreting the Quran, but this interpretation has been made each time, or each example, it has been made not according to the rules in which, linguistic rules in which the Quran has been articulated, but according to the new conceptions prevailing in 9th century, 8th century, 10th century, in the Abbasid period, in the Fatimid period, in each time you have the cultural context, the historical context, the political context, which will influence the interpretation of the interpreter. This is also shown by the linguistic analysis. And you see the discrepancies which will happen between the interpreted corpuses, which are the work of the community, the interpreting community, and the Quranic text as it is in the official corpus. And you see how many issues, how many problems we have to solve with the disciplines I mentioned if we want to get to a new modern understanding of the place of the Quran as the source of Islamic religion, as a religion, and to make a distinction between the spiritual teaching of the Quran to enhance and enlighten the religious faith and to distinguish this from all the political issues which have been added to the Quran, projected into the Quran by all the interpreters through the struggle through which Muslim communities went through history. And here you can understand the role of Ismaili thought in this long and complex struggle about the meaning of the Quran. Ismaili movement went and contributed to the debate how to approach the Quran, how to read the Quran, and took their own positions, developed their own conceptions, and debated with other interpretations and conceptions, and they have been a part, an important part of this big movement, which started with the Quran and which is still continuing, because this debate is not closed, is not finished. As you see, if we go the way I am tracing here, we are going to open up wide spaces, new possibilities for debates, and then there will be no place for saying Ismailis are a sect. They are out of the Orthodox Islam. Sunni saying about Imamis, they are a sect, they are out of Orthodoxy. And Shia is saying about Sunnis, they are out of Orthodoxy. You see what has happened. We are entrapped in the heresiographical definitions of several communities which participated to the debate about the meaning of the Quran, because each community claims the right to deliver the most orthodox interpretation of the Word of God. And you see that it is not easy to get into the debate if we take the position, the theological position of each community, excluding the others. The only way today to integrate all the known and manifested positions about the meaning of the Quran without excluding any voice and without saying that this voice is heterodox and this voice is orthodox. The only way to do that is to come back to this critical posture of reason, saying, I am not going to participate to the polemics about the meaning of the Quran. I am going only to show you, as I try to do, how difficult and complex it is to approach such a text. And I am trying to show the conditions to which anyone who has the ambition to come and to tell what's the meaning of the Quran has first to fulfill the present conditions. Linguistic conditions, historical conditions, anthropological conditions. If you have enough time in your life to fulfill all these conditions, then you can come and say, there is the meaning. But you see that this endeavor cannot have a limit. There is always something more to tell, something more to discover, and something more to discuss. That's why religions, as we said in the beginning, are coming back, because all the endeavor displayed by scholars, thinkers, philosophers, theologians, didn't yet come to the last word about the richness of religious texts. But we are enriched by all the discoveries which we are making through this text, and we are now struggling to go further, much further, than the reason of enlightenment has been. Because what reason of enlightenment did, as I told you, has been to put aside the issue of religion and to say, we don't touch it. You do what you want to do. Reason of enlightenment created a space for free research, for free scientific activity. Okay, it's very good. We need it. It didn't exist before. But it didn't help to consider the issue of religion as a human dimension of human history, and to study religions with this open mind and with a serious interest in the role which still religions have to play in our history. And we have to face this idea of God coming back after the death of God has been proclaimed in Europe at the end of the 19th century. I don't know if you read, for example, very important and nice book by the German philosopher Nietzsche, who showed what he calls the genealogy of the death of God. What does this mean, death of God? It's what I told you about reason of enlightenment, which say we do not need to refer anymore to God to go further in the scientific knowledge. So God has been put aside. This is the meaning of the expression, God is dead. Of course, God cannot die. It's a metaphor. To say that there has been an evolution, an intellectual evolution in human mind, which made human mind free from the reference, the necessary reference to God. Up to 18th, 19th century, as I told you, there was a necessity always to refer to God. After God became something which is up to each individual to refer to or not refer to. But now God is coming back, as we say, I mean, religion is playing again an important role in politics, especially. But the role it is playing, especially in Muslim world, as you see, well, I told you, the role which religion is playing is not yet based on a critical, intellectual, scientific control. And the role of religion is based, so far, on mythological representations of what religion is. Muslims are referring to abstract principles which are reported to the time of the Prophet, to the person of the Prophet, without any historical control, like, for example, controlling what Quran is about and how to approach. This doesn't bother the majority of Muslims, who are referring to very large and abstract principles, saying, for example, that the state founded by the Prophet in Medina is the ideal state. It is much better than the democratic states which we know now in Europe. Then we have to go back to that state and replace what we have today, which are imitations of the states, so-called democratic states founded in Europe. This is the language that we have, and you see that this language, of course, is not based on serious control, on serious approach of the issue of religion, which remains extremely complex and which requires from us a lot of attention to improve, especially to improve the system of education. That's why His Highness insists so much on the creation of a university of Islamic studies, because he knows what's going on in the Muslim world. He knows what's going on inside Islamic thought. He knows the shortcomings inside the Ismaili community itself about all these issues. And he's worried about the implementing, the enhancing of a theological thinking in Ismaili community. When we met him the first time, the board of governors met him 1 year ago, he insisted specifically on the lack of theological thinking in contemporary Islamic thought. I had no time to show you why theological thinking disappeared from Islamic thinking since 12th, 13th century. There is no more theology, no more improvement, no more progress in building a theological thinking in Islam, in all communities, Sunni, Shia, Ismaili, whatever. Why is that? And why Christians didn't stop developing a theology, Catholic theology, Protestant theology, Orthodox theology less, because Christian orthodoxy is influenced by Eastern history, like Islam. It's also another chapter. Yes, it's another chapter to explain why Orthodox Christianity went almost the same intellectual way as Islam, apart from what has happened in Europe. This is a big issue to understand what happened in Israel. So it is true that we do not have theological thinking. And we have even less philosophical analysis of the religious dimension. I have to mention philosophy before I close this. Philosophy is an important discipline, intellectual discipline, because only philosophy obliges us to question reason for all its products, for all its thinking. Philosophy asks to reason, where do you get your right to say what you say? There is a constant dialogue, critical dialogue, of reason with itself. Reason suspects itself. And this discipline of suspecting one's self, of suspecting everything told, elaborated by reason, only philosophy teaches it. Theology doesn't. Because theology works inside the Word of God. Reason cannot raise a question about the Word of God. It accepts all the Word of God. It reflects inside, but it doesn't raise questions about the Word of God. Philosophy does. It says, how can I understand this phenomenon? That's why I call it phenomenon. You see? And you have to remember that philosophy as an intellectual discipline has been practiced in Islamic thought, and especially in Ismaili tradition, up to 12th century. Then it disappeared. No more philosophy. And until today, we are without philosophical references in Islamic thought. That's why we can speak of the accumulated through centuries, accumulated unthought, not thought of in Islamic thought. Many problems which are left unthought. It means which have not been examined through philosophical approach and philosophical analysis. Because philosophy as a discipline is not taught, is ignored, it has disappeared, even more than theology. So you see, the amount of work and the ways of also, which are open before us. But these ways and this work, unfortunately, is not yet undertaken as it should be. And I must confess how sad I am as a member of the Board of Governors. We are looking for an executive officer for the Institute in London since 2 years, and we didn't find one. I take this as an example to excite your imagination and to try to think why in the whole community we cannot find a man or a woman. I have a preference for a woman. I've expressed it several times for several reasons. To run this institute, which is an exciting place, with all the vision put in it by His Highness, and all the future that it can have in the lives I'm describing. I finish with that, and I thank you for your attention.
Now, wasn't that refreshing? I mean, I'm out of words here, but I would say it was interesting, thought-provoking, and truly educational. You've left us here with so many things that I need a couple of nights to rethink, refocus, and absorb all that. Thank you very much, Professor Arkun. I also need to correct myself. I say Professor Muhammad Arkun was one of the leading thinkers in the Islamic world. After tonight, I think we'll all agree, not only in the Islamic world, but I think in the entire world, he's a leading thinker. Thank you very much once again. While we were driving from the hotel to this place here, we were trying to cajole Professor Arkun in agreeing to stay a few more days so he can complete his elaboration on some of his topics that he left unfinished. So here is an open invitation again, Professor Arkun. We are ready to have you again anytime you're ready for us. Thank you.
But tell him on Friday the planes are not flying.
Yes, yes, yes. We have a strike in Ontario, by the way, so you can't fly on Friday anymore. We'll keep it open for some questions or comments or suggestions that you have. There's a mic in the middle of the room there. Please come up and speak your mind out.
How can we revive the cultural
I think you mentioned during the period of
contemporary period, Islamic identity and contributions to society were greatly, you know, profoundly highlighted during those times.
Yes.
And the question is, how can we revive some of those really laid out Islamic identity?
Yes, this question of revival is very often repeated and claimed by Muslims, and this claim shows the lack of historical thinking in the present time, because this period, which we call the classical period, has definitely produced major contributions to scientific knowledge, to thinking, to philosophical, theological thinking, to juridical elaborations. It is a brilliant contribution, undoubtedly. But we must pay attention that all what has been done in this period, which is described by historians as the medieval period, which is distinguished from the later periods after 16th century, which is the period of modernity. Modernity made totally obsolete all the thinking, all the scientific knowledge which has been developed in medieval ages. For example, the discovery made by Galileo about the earth turning around the sun. The contrary was believed, was taught in medieval ages. And this is totally obsolete. The thinking of Ibn Rushd, the great philosopher Ibn Rushd, who developed a very important philosophical theory to harmonize faith and reason according to the conceptions and knowledge which prevailed in medieval ages. This philosopher, thinker, Muslim thinker, influenced thinkers in Europe in 13th century, at the Sorbonne, at Oxford University, at Bologna University. He had a great success. But again, after 16th century, new horizons, new postures of mind, new discoveries came and made obsolete this rich thinking. So the problem is not to reactivate this thinking, but only to know it historically and to see how these thinkers have considered problems like I showed, for example, for interpretation of the Quran, or problems of law, elaboration of law, just to know how they worked and considered the issue of religion in their time, for historical curiosity, not to reproduce their interpretation and to rely on their interpretation. This is over. We have to look for new positions, for new cultures, for new intellectual attitudes, as I showed, for example, for the Quran, like Christians, Jews, and others are doing for their own tradition. This is the move of history. And Muslims, unfortunately, are looking back because they are fascinated by this period, which, as I told, they don't know well historically, but they refer to it as a mythical period to oppose their civilization at that period to the Europeans, and to say to Europeans, we too, we made it. It's not only you who made what you made. We too, we made it. Yes, we made it, but in medieval ages. We didn't make it after 16th century. And the principle, the battle today is the battle about modernity. how to understand it and how to use it today. It's not the battle of going back to, again, a Bryant period, but a period which cannot help us to stand today facing the challenges, the new challenges of history and the new challenges of modernity. Now, the quotation you made, religions, we cannot ask the religions to give more than they can give. Yes, because religions tried to solve human issues in human existence. For example, religions taught ethics to overcome violence. Violence is inherent in human being and in human existence. We do not know of any society, of any culture, devoid from the use of violence to get to power. It is an anthropological dimension of human being. You see, we don't pay enough attention to this dimension. We behave as if we were angels. We are not. We are violent, even in individual relationship. We can become very violent, and we become violent. Even in the family relationship, we can become violent. So violence is a dimension which has been considered by religions, and religions tried to overcome this dimension in our social life, in our political life, etc., in our private life, by teaching ethics, ethical values. So they contributed to this, but their contribution was limited by the culture of the time when these religions emerged for the first time. Religions are limited because they didn't evolve. They resisted through time to the evolutions which took place in history. Look, for example, what I mentioned about the church in Europe, which resisted to scientific discoveries. For example, the church condemned Galileo when he said what he said. The church didn't accept to contribute to the Declaration of Human Rights made in France by the French Revolution. They resisted in the name of their beliefs as it was taught in theology. So religions are limited, and religions are in need to evolve, like everything in the history of cultures, history of civilizations. And this dialogue between historical evolution and religions is very difficult to carry on. You see now the resistance of fundamentalist Islam to modernity as it is. They say we don't need this modernity because it's materialist, because it's this, without examining what modernity is about, as you see. That's why I think we have to evaluate correctly, objectively, what religions can give and what they cannot give. They can definitely help to give a sense of spirituality, a sense that human being is violent, but he is also able to develop a humanist attitude, to build a humanist culture, a humanist society. He's able to do this. So this, from this, that point of view, religions can still contribute.
We'll take a couple of more questions if there are. Yes.
one of us.